Wow. How's everybody doing tonight? I'm not sure how I'm doing. It's been a kind of a crazy day. I had a conference all day with my two roommates about this talk tonight. You know, we talked all day long, me, myself, and I. And I probably heard my story in 17 different ways over the course of the day. And, you know, they told me that there's a story you think of before the thing, the one that comes out of your mouth, and then, of course, on the drive home, what you should have said. You know, sitting in my chair, I was really trying to recenter because my head was just spinning. And I said, God, I'm going to move my lips tonight, and you're going to have to do the talking. He hasn't got there yet, but you know, I'm still waiting for him. I know he'll be along shortly. Anyway, I'm always proud to give a talk in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys have changed my life. I'm a gutter drunk. I'm a blackout drinker. I started young, had my first drink at age 7. I was in jail by 16 for the first time. Lost count of how many times I've lived on the streets. None of it had to do with my father being an alcoholic. None of it had to do with how I was treated, growing up. Those mean teachers who tried to teach me stuff, that didn't have anything to do with it. What it comes down to is that I'm allergic to alcohol. I have an allergy. And if I put it in my body, this craving thing starts. And I got to have more. Now, I've come to find, since being sober, that applies to a lot of different things for me. Anything that feels good, I always want more. You know? When I get pay raises, I want more. You know, give me the next pay raise. You know, I realize that it's only been 2 weeks, but I think I need another one. That sort of thing. I was born in Buffalo, New York, right near Niagara Falls, and my father was, in fact, alcoholic. He didn't stay around long. He was a runner, a gambler, the whole nine yards, which is what I turned into. And for a guy who said, I'll never be like my dad, I may have been worse. I don't know. He left when I was 7, and that was the last I ever saw of him. We finally found him in 2001, but the problem was I couldn't go do the two things that I'd always said I was going to do. Take his ass out back at the bar, whip him for leaving us alone, and then buy him a drink. You know, because he was already dead. He'd been dead for 15 years. So my amends have been, to him, have been on paper. My talking to him have been through the Spirit. I didn't get a whole lot of trouble early on, but I knew that first time that I drank, that I thought they saved my life that day. You know, I was a kid who did not fit in, always trying to run away from whatever reality presented. There were times when my brother, who's a year younger than me, we look almost like, not anymore, because his hair isn't white, but he doesn't have much. Anyway, he's not here to defend himself? Anyway, I would say that to his face anyway. Anyway, but we looked almost like twins, except I was always just that little bit taller than him growing up, and yet somehow I didn't think I felt like I was part of this family that I grew up in. I have since come to find out that most of that feeling was my fault. I did things to separate myself. You know, to get attention. Because that's the thing at that age that I wanted more of. That's the thing that made me feel good. Even if that attention was not good attention. Like I said, when I was 16, I did my first little jail trip for stealing my stepfather's car. He wasn't real happy that I stole it. He was really not happy that I brought it home with a bullet hole in it. I don't know if he ever got that fixed or not. They kicked me out not long after that. Ran me off, you know. I was almost 17. My mother had had enough. I thought I was the black sheep of the family. And somebody said, you can join the military. I can find myself there, you know. So I got my mother to sign the papers. And off to San Antonio, Texas, to the tune of a different drummer I was 3 days later. And, oh my God, as good as I thought I could drink, my God, them boys taught me something about drinking. I spent almost 6 years in the military. I was a super troop at work. But, you know, after work was over, I'd make sure the uniform was right, the boots were polished to the max so that I could get to work and look great the next day. But, boy, the stories I heard at the NCO club the next night. You know where we found you last night, Bill? You know, how I got back to the barracks and was in my bed, I have no clue most of the time. Sometimes I found myself off base and in a real rush to get to work. I just thought of a time when we stayed up all night playing cards. We were snorting something up our noses and drinking like crazy guys up right upstairs. I went down. We realized it at 6:30 that it was 6:30, and we had to be at guard mount at 7. So quick showers, splash on as much aftershave, and brush our teeth 5 times in a half an hour. And when I got to the armory to get my weapon, the guy said, you can't have your weapon today, you're drunk. And I was just like, oh man, I'm going to be in so much trouble. So I went back upstairs, splashed some more aftershave on, brushed my teeth again, and went to the captain and said, he won't give me my gun. You know, I said, we stopped at 11 last night. You know, you got to stop 8 hours prior. Now, we drank last night, but we stopped at 11, and he took me in there, and he gave me my gun. I was good to go, you know, because my uniform was tight. I mean, I was tight. And anyway, I spent a couple years over in Germany and about a year and a half in Greece, and, you know, I learned, well, at the time, I don't think I learned anything. I think I learned it all since I got here because of all that experience that I had. But I learned how to seek out the people that I could take advantage of and learn those sorts of skills. I learned some management skills, and I still work pretty well with people even today, even when I'm angry. But I got out of the military, and I got the opportunity to find out real quick that without a barracks to go laid my head down in, a mess hall to go eat in, a hospital in case I get sick, that I ain't got no support out here in the outside world. And so, needless to say, it didn't take me long to have to go to the appliance store to get the materials for my new apartment. Cardboard box, you know, tarp, those sorts of things, burlap sack for my refrigerator. Because I am a master outdoorsman, and I practice that skill. Well, come to Soberstock next week. You will see me practicing some of that skill. I just won't be doing it in a cardboard box this year. You know, it started getting cold around middle of November one year. I think that was 1982 or something like that. And I called my mother up because I was living out of doors. I had to go down to the Y and clean my act up because I was looking pretty ratty and hadn't worked in God knows how long. I'd get, you know, to panhandle and the given blood, whatever it took to get the next drink. And she, of course, had her little rule about you're going to go find a job, and I just, well, I don't know about all that, but I'll placate you and tell you I'll go look for a job. And I was up every morning, got dressed, left the house, but I wasn't looking for no job. But I told her I had some prospects here and prospects there. What it was try to get together a couple of bucks so I could go to the bar and get started, because once I got started, I'd find a way to drink, even if I had to hold you up. Some tough times. The cool part about that little period in my life was that I still had some of me left, some of what I had been taught growing up left in there. And the guilt and remorse started to build, because my mother still had two little kids from my stepfather that she was trying to raise. And here I wasn't pitching anything in the pot to help pay the bills. You know, she was feeding me and things like that. So one cold December morning, I had been talking to a guy who lived down in Stuart, Florida. And he said he got in a lot of trouble with me one time when we were still in high school. And he said, "Man, we're building houses like they're going out of style, no end in sight." Hey, let me tell you, up until about a year and a half ago, you could still say that. But it took me a little while to make that decision, but the guilt and remorse started piling up, and I couldn't stay there with my mother. And one morning, it was about 6 inches of snow on the ground, and I decided to move to Florida. And that's how I moved to Florida. I had my little duffel bag. It took me 110 days to get here. And what's so funny? I had good housing. I was in a little crossbar hotel up around Atlanta. When I got out of there, the judge said, "Just never come back to my town." Hopefully I'll remember later on. I can tie that up to another funny story. I came to Florida, and when I got here, they were building houses. I did get the opportunity to learn a couple things about myself while we were doing that house building job. And it was this guy and his brother and his dad ran the crew. And we got paid daily. Cash. What a great job for a drunk like me. I found out, the couple things I found out was, number one, I'm not a carpenter. And the second thing I found out was I'm not a carpenter's helper either. So that job didn't last me very, very long. I went to work in this little gas station. I was living in this trailer with my buddy and his wife, and they had a kid, and I was sleeping on the couch. And we would have a real nice dinner, get full, and then I'd say I need to go out for a walk. And, of course, you know, I had a pocket full of cash. You know where I was going. And I would always wake up the next morning on the couch. A lot of times there was stuff on the coffee table that obviously came out of somebody's house. And so I like to think that I was probably, well, I don't like to think it, but I believe I was a blackout burglar, because I got no recollection of where most of that stuff came from. And sometimes it's some pretty valuable stuff. One day I took a set of keys that were on that table when the bottom had fallen out and found that car, because the address was on the keychain. And I took the car, and not the first time I stole a car. Actually, it was the third time I stole a car. Anyway, I was heading up north. I was, you know, it was warm again out. And if my mother wouldn't take me in, I didn't mind living in Mount Airy Forest in a box, because it's beautiful up there in the summertime around Cincinnati, Ohio. Anyway, Bill knows what I'm talking about. You've been there. Anyway, I almost got there. And then I got woke up in a rest area early one morning with six shotguns pointing at me. That's not a pleasant thing. I don't recommend that. And they brought me back to Florida, and I did a little bit of time. and a long probation. And over the course of that probation, you know, I got arrested a few times, usually drunk and disorderly, public intoxication, and, you know, I must have been a pretty friendly, sloppy drunk because, you know, they never violated my probation, which was a good thing. I started selling powdered alcohol. You use it a different way. It's not really alcohol, but anyway, it has an effect on you. Let's just put it that way. And anyway, I started selling stuff like that, and one day the cops tied that up with the violation of probation, come looked in my house, and, you know, thank God I cleaned the house, but they still violated my probation, and I had to do a little bit of jail time. And all these times I went to jail, the preachers would come in. I don't know that I ever saw an actual AA meeting come into any of the jails I was in. Maybe they were there, maybe not. But the preachers would always come in, and I'd go to the bars, and I'd talk to them. See, I believe all my life that's what I've been looking for, is this God of my understanding. And while I didn't have the booze, which was my God of my understanding, those preachers would suffice. And I would feel a little more comfortable when I was locked up. And I do all that praying stuff. I'm not sure if I knew who, what, where I was praying to, because here I was locked up, and I guess my main thought was, you ain't helping me here. I'm locked up again, dude. You know, kind of stuff. And but the last time I went to jail was on this violation of probation, and I got sentenced to the 60-day deal and 4 ADAP meetings, which were a county-run program. And I get in a cell, and I saw my first big book. And it wasn't paper. It was a man who was serving some amends time. And he was in my cell. And this guy talked to me. He said, they're bringing this ADAP meeting in. And I said, bringing an ADAP? What is that? Oh, ADAP. Wait a minute. I got to do that. I got 4 of these to do. I'm going to be here for 8 weeks. I'm knocking out 2 birds with 1 stone. I'm running the show here. And he says, yeah, man, they bring coffee. I'm like, cool. They bring cookies. I'm like, awesome. And sometimes girls show up to carry this message. And I'm like, awesome, man, I'm there. So we get out of the cell. We go to this ADAP meeting. There ain't no girls. Ain't no cookies, and ain't no damn coffee. I was in there for 6 weeks, and none of those 3 showed up any of those times. I was mad as a hornet, but it got me out of the cell. And God works in strange ways, in my mind. He planted a seed somewhere. Is that me? Get away from me. He planted a seed during one of those ADAP meetings, maybe all of them, I don't know. But I got out of jail, and somehow I started to believe that there was some small possibility, probably not, but a possibility that maybe alcohol had something to do with getting locked up, being homeless, broken marriages. I really didn't think so, though. But I thought, let's try not drinking for a while and see what happens. That was the thought I left jail with. And so I didn't drink that day, and I really didn't want to go home because, you know, we are pretty sick when we have untreated alcoholism. And at the time, I thought this girl that I lived with, it was all her fault as to why I went to jail. Now, I violated the probation. I'm the one who sold the dope. You know, she was just there, you know. Wasn't her fault in the least. But my brain told me it was her fault. You know, I was confused. I was dazed and confused. And so I didn't go home that first night, and I slept out on the beach. And it was a beautiful April night. I think it was April the 23rd, 1988. April 22nd, I take that back, because I woke up on a Friday morning, which was April the 23rd, 1988. And here was 2 of the guards from the jailhouse fishing with a big cooler of beer. And they said, "Bill, good to see you out of jail. Come on over here and have a beer with us this morning." Well, man, it's about 8:30 in the morning. And the light bulb went off. "Bill, you're trying not to drink." And this is probably the first time I ever turned down a beer in my life. I said, "No, I don't think so." I don't know where that came from, but it came from somewhere. But you know, by about 9:30, 10 o'clock, it was starting to get kind of hot out there on the beach. So I thought maybe I have just one of these beers. Again, the God of my understanding has a real sense of humor, because he only allowed me to remember about the first half of that beer, and he put me in a blackout. And I woke up the next morning, 100 miles north up in Melbourne, sleeping on somebody's living room floor. My first thought was, "Oh God, I did another blackout job." Only I didn't make it out of the house. Had no idea where I was at. But what happened to me that morning when I opened my eyes was what some kid said while I was locked up in one of those ADAP meetings. That seed that had been planted that I had no clue was even in there. And it rang true. Now, this had happened hundreds of times because I lost weeks sometimes with my drinking. But I know I'm an alcoholic, because when I pick up the very first one, I don't know how many I'm going to drink, how much I'm going to drink, or where I'm going to end up. Boom. It happened to me while the seed was in there. It happened to me lots of times before that. If it's for me, tell them I'm a little busy at the moment. Thank God that I got out trying to save time on those ADAP meetings, because, see, I thought I'd knock that little requirement out that the judge threw at me. And so now it's Saturday morning, and I'm like, "Where are we?" "Well, we're up in Melbourne." And, "Well, dude, you're one party, and here's these cops. They're sleeping on the couch. I'm on the floor." And they're like, "Dude, we ain't never seen nobody party like you party. I mean, they told me I drank 2/5 of Jack Daniels, and I never slurred a word and never staggered once. And I was dancing all night long." So, right away, my ego's like, "I'm the man." You know, how quickly we forget. You know, when 2 minutes prior to that, I knew that I cannot drink safely. How do we get here? Well, you rented a car and drove. Oh, my God. Well, I knew that this little girl that lived with me was going to be coming to visit me. It's Saturday. We better hurry our ass home back to Stuart. That's neither here nor there. But Sunday evening, the ADAP guy calls me up and he says, "We're going to see you this Wednesday, right?" And I said, "Oh, Jeff, no way. I didn't remember you saw me there while we were in jail. You came every time. I was there. I did my stuff, and I'm good." And he laughed. He thought that was funny. He said, "No, that doesn't count. It's too easy in jail." Damn it. You know, I was mad. And then my boss called. Now, I've been locked up for 6 weeks, and my boss calls me up, and he says, "Bill, I heard you got out of jail, and you going to be at work tomorrow morning?" "What? I still have a job?" He said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Well, sure, I'll be there." And, you know, my job at this company at the time, I'd been there for less than a year, and I started there at $4 an hour, answering the telephone, writing the questions down, taking the phone number and the guy's name and giving it to the boss, and he called him back, because it was an electrical contracting generator company, and I knew nothing about either of those. And it's $4 an hour, it's under the table. And the first day I offered to type the invoices, because I knew I typed better than my boss, and he let me do that, and he gave me a dollar raise the next day. And about 3 weeks later, I showed some initiative to try to sell some parts, and he gave me another dollar an hour raise, and I think I'd had one or two more. And here we are almost a year later, and I'm getting out of jail. Now, I'm wearing my own shirt, not a tie or anything, and these guys all got, like, uniform shirts with collars and her name and the company name, and you know, they all matched. And here I had like a dress shirt on answering the phones. And when I got to the office the next morning, here was a stack of shirts for me like the rest of the guys, another dollar an hour raise. And I was amazed. God was working in my life, and I didn't know how at the time, but didn't even know it was God at the time, but I was just like blessed. That Wednesday I went to the ADAP meeting, and I had four of these things to do, and I went from Wednesday to Wednesday to Wednesday. I don't recommend this to anybody. It's like going to one meeting a week when you're brand new and raw with untreated alcoholism, but that's what I was doing. I was holding on all week till Wednesday, and I'd listen intently to what they were saying. And we got to the last Wednesday, and I didn't know what to do because there's no next Wednesday. And I stayed late. I was scared because I knew for a fact that I couldn't safely drink alcohol, but I didn't know how I was going to do it by myself. I knew there was some kind of power with a group of people. So I asked the guy, what am I supposed to do now? And he said, Bill, he laughed, of course. Same guy, he laughed. I thought he was laughing at me. He probably was. He said, haven't you heard a word we've been telling you? I said, what do you mean? I've been listening intently. He said, we've been telling you to go to AA. What? That was May the 18th, 1988, that Wednesday, and he gave me a little meeting schedule and a map of Fellowship Hall, and he said, you know where that's at? And there's a 7 o'clock meeting tomorrow. It's a great meeting. And I drove around about quarter to seven, and here's this big crowd of people, and I'm thinking, dude, you got to just keep going because they'll know. And I drove around that block, and sure enough, I come around 7 o'clock, nobody there. I'm like, okay, now I can park. So I parked about 6 blocks away. Now I'm walking around a 3 or 4 block area down there in downtown Stewart. And sure enough, I walked around the corner at 8 o'clock, and here's this crowd of people, and I'm trying to keep a straight face so they just won't know that I'm an alcoholic, that I have a problem with booze, and excuse me, sir, excuse me, ma'am, you know, making my way through the crowd, but I knew there was an 8:30 meeting, and the back door was open just a crack to let the smoke out, and I slipped my butt in that room. The room was packed, and there was a seat in the very back corner of the room, and thank God there was a lady who had big red hair. It's huge. Great hiding place. I'm using her to kind of navigate and look around the room to see who might recognize me, because, you know, they might tell my boss that I got a problem with booze. They might tell this girlfriend that I got a problem with booze. Like they didn't already know, of course. But I was scared to death. The only guy in the room I recognized was the friggin' guy chairing. He was the only guy facing towards me. So I'm working this thing, and the steps are up behind him. And, I started working the steps, because I heard some people saying the steps were important. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I had that down. Solid. 100%. Life is unmanageable. Well, I live in a house. I got a job. I got a girlfriend in a car. And I used to eat out of the dumpster and live in a cardboard. My life isn't really unmanageable. But I got the first part, and that works for me. And so I moved on. And I didn't know about this God thing because he really hadn't done anything. I believe there was one. I did do, I don't know that I was even agnostic. I knew there was a God. Just hadn't done anything for me. But then when step three said, turn my will and life over, I'm thinking, I'm in trouble now. So what was I to do? I knew I didn't want to drink anymore. I knew I couldn't do it safely. I said, okay, dude, you got it. And then I took a quick inventory about stealing that and doing that. Okay, I'm good. And I figured if God knew and I knew, there was no real reason to tell somebody else. So I was done with step five. And the point was that, my mother kicked me out as an act of tough love when I was 16. Because she had been taught that in Al-Anon. And so I thought she hated me. That was tough love. But I knew that I had stolen from her. I had upset her many times. I had gone sometimes 4 or 5 years without contacting her. She didn't know I was alive or dead. And she, I called her up after that meeting when I got home because I needed to make amends. And of course, being a 30-plus year member of Al-Anon at the time, she quickly laughed at me. She thought that was one of the funniest things she had heard in a while. Hey, Mom, I just started AA today, and I have to make these amends. You know, and she just laughed. But she said some powerful words that night, and I'll never forget those. And she said to me, Bill, if you never, ever drink again, that would be amends enough for me. And from that day, May the 19th, 1988, to this day, I haven't picked up a drink. And that's the day I call my sobriety date, even though I didn't drink a month prior to that. It's the first day that I did something about my problem with alcohol. Now, I can't give you no rosy picture of how I grasped the steps walking in these rooms and ran with them and changed my life in the first 24 hours. I do know there are some people who have done that. I wasn't quite ready. The good news was I had the main part of step one down so pat that I wasn't going to drink. The only problem with that, I don't recommend just not drinking. I would get up in the morning, go to the 7:15 meeting in the morning before work. After work, I would go promptly to the 5:30 meeting. Chit-chat. Oh, they got a 7 o'clock meeting here at the hall? That's fine. We'll stay for that since it's already 7 o'clock. And then, chit-chat after the 7 o'clock. Oh, 8:30 meeting. Might as well have another meeting while we're here. 3-4 meetings every day. What I know today is I was hiding out in Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't want to face life. I didn't want to do the steps with another person because I thought I was different. Any of you get up in the morning and think about yourselves? That's how it is for me, every day. My first thought is about me. The only time I think about you is if it has something to do with me. So, I kept coming to these meetings. And, you know, I was a scared little kid. I was in my 20s. And they, you know, after the meetings, there'd be these crowds of people, and I didn't know what to do to join in those conversations. And I would kind of stand around the edge and look wistful, you know. You know, those sorts of things. And one evening after the Sunday night young people's meeting at Fellowship Hall there, somebody said, Bill, they're talking to me. They're talking to me. Bill, we're going to go have ice cream and watch a movie. Would you like to come with us? I was in. And all of a sudden, I was having conversations with people. You know, all of a sudden, I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I was busy working the steps. I was going to step meetings. I was going to big book meetings. I was trying to learn all I could learn, and I was trying real hard. And I didn't want anybody to get sober faster than me. You know, I'd have 5-6 months, and somebody with 3 months, and my sponsor had me on step four, and I'd go home right away. Write that first name in 15 pages. And I thought, man, I got a lot of people. This ain't ever going to work. And the day came, I was probably about 2.5 years without a drink. I call that my sobriety period. And over the course of those 2.5 years, you know, I could work it at work. I could come to the AA meeting. Everything was wonderful, if you asked. I'm sober now. It's great. But that knot in my gut was growing. And it starts to get like a snowball. You know, in the beginning, the snowball only grows a little. And the further you go with the snow, it gets big real fast. And it was getting real big and painful. And I found myself out on the pool deck behind my house one night. Taste of gun oil in my mouth. And I was ready to go. And then God intervened. And somebody walked up, and my ego wouldn't let them know what I was doing right then. So, hide my gun. And, the next day, the teacher appeared. I put on my smiley face again for the AA meeting. And the guy said, "Bill, how you doing?" And I said, "I'm great, how are you?" And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "Bullshit." Because he could read me. He knew. He knew my pain. Is that my time or is that another phone call for me? I'm still busy. And we sat down on the park bench on the river there in beautiful downtown Stuart, Florida. Some people know right where that's at in the room. And right out of the big book. He showed me how my life was unmanageable. That was a hard concept for me. But I began to see that brick wall that I kept hitting and wonder why the same crap kept happening over and over and over again, even without a drink. Then he gets on his knees. This guy, he got long hair, he's got a beard. He gets on his knees, he puts his hands out, he says, "Now we're going to say the third step prayer." And I looked at him like, "Well, how come your hands are out?" He says, "Because you're going to hold my hands while we say this prayer." And I'm just like, "I don't know the prayer." He sets the book down on the ground. He said, "Just read it." How simple this thing is. And I mean, we're in downtown Stuart, Florida now. I'm looking around. There's people milling around here and there. And I get on my knees. I grab this guy's hands. I read that prayer about as fast as I can read it. And I'm up and I'm looking. Who saw that? And this guy didn't budge. He got this big grin on his face. He's on his knees. Hands are out. He's looking like Jesus. You know. Anyway, that's what he looked like the pictures I've seen. Sorry. Anyway, he says, "Now that you know you can do it, let's do it right this time." And I was like, "Man." He said, "You said you're willing to go to any length. This is your life." That's what he pointed out. "It's my life. You can either continue with that gut-wrenching knot and probably die soon, or you can do this." I was like, "Well, I got nothing to lose." And I got on my knees. He said, "Just think about the words as you read them." And I read the words. And funny, you know, those first 2.5 years, I got up every morning, opened that book to that third step prayer. I said that prayer right out of the book, and yet I couldn't remember it. And that second time I did it that day, I can't forget it now, which is an awesome deal. But as I read the words and I realized this ain't about me. You know, we're asking God to help us out here, and the main purpose so we can go help somebody else out. You know, I got to be free of myself. And we sat right there. He showed me how to work that four step, and I never saw the word, "We made a list." I never saw that little statement there. That's why I'd write one name in 15 pages. But he explained to me that I make a list so that I can see how many there are, and then I'll just write one or two things about each person. Only took a few hours. And before I knew it, I gave this guy my whole life story. Then he told me to go home for an hour, think about what I had done. And I did that. And I called him up, and he said, "Come over to my apartment." Thank God we did the seven-step prayer indoors. You know, but the next day, I was out making amends. Anybody got some water? No? My life changed that day. Probably getting to be too late anyway, because I've been yelled at once. And, that's not your spit, is it? Well, I seen him spitting in a cup earlier, you know. I'm thinking that might be like drinking booze. Maybe. Thanks, man. Anyway, like I said, I don't recommend anybody, if you're new, and you got a sponsor who's ready, willing, and able to take you through the steps, let them take you through the steps. And I say that so you don't have to be as miserable as I was for over 2 years. That's a painful spot to be in. Some people actually pull the trigger. And I think had God not had somebody walk up on me, I wouldn't be standing here giving this talk today. God had a plan. Thank God I was still in it. I'm still in it today. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is given me a way to live. Whether it's good, bad, doesn't matter what's going on in the outside part of my life, I can be comfortable inside here with Bill. Sometimes I still want to talk myself into I don't fit in. But deep down I know I do. Because what I found out is everywhere I'm at, God put me there. There's a reason I'm doing whatever it is I'm doing. Not that I don't have my own self-will that sometimes still runs riot. But I'm certainly blessed to be here to talk to you folks tonight. You know, I've got several sponsees, and about 45 minutes before we got here, a buddy of mine offered to pick me up, and I said, well, I'm going to pick this new sponsee up. And he says, well, I'll drive. I said, okay, that's fine. That'll give me time to, you know, concentrate on talking to this kid. And we get to the guy's street. Kid hadn't been able to stay sober. His higher power is a little unconventional. It's music, whatever that means. So we get on the street. I call him up and say, come on out to the curb. We're going to pick you up here in a minute. And he said, a funny thing happened. Now, I just talked to him at 1 o'clock today. My drummer showed up, and we got an emergency band practice. I said, man, I got to use that sometime. Now, that's not what I said at the time. I almost reached through that phone for this guy's neck is what happened. I was pissed. And I let him know on no uncertain terms that obviously this music was much more important than his sobriety. Been sober a week and a half or something like that. And that's sad. Because this guy's probably not going to make it here if he continues this kind of behavior. I've seen it 1,000 times. Maybe he will hold on. But I remember the first time that I said I had something else to do other than get to a meeting that I had committed to. And my sponsor at the time almost came through the phone at my throat. But I ended up going to the meeting. And I'm still here today sober. Hopefully I've carried some kind of a message of sobriety today. You know, life out here today isn't great. But life in here with me, the three of us get along pretty darn good today. And I thank you for letting me share.
Can we have another round of applause for both speakers? So I've asked Amanda to read Dr. Bob's last message. Right. I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first...